Good evening. Welcome to the Celerity Report. Today is July 16th, 2015. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. I'm road tripping again, somewhere between Albuquerque and Flagstaff. I'll stay over in Flagstaff tonight, and then on to Palo Alto. I just stopped to record somewhere in America. Normally, I do this trip in 3 days. This time, I'm taking five. I realized, you know, why don't I stop and take some time to visit with people and really enjoy the journey. So we'll see if the 5 days works. Coming back on the road trip from California back to Tennessee in August, I'll be coming through Austin, Texas. We're going to have a great lunch with subscribers in Austin at Jasper's. Some of the people who were at New York lunch and the California workshop are going to be there, so we're going to have a very great crowd. And then we're working on one for Amsterdam and Holland on October 17th, so if you're in Europe, stay tuned. But hold that date. Our theme tonight is predatory lending blowback, because you're watching Europe now in the throes with the final resolution on this Greek bailout, or I should say Greek renegotiation, hardly a bailout. There's very many interesting things about it. One of the most shocking is that Greece did not have an exit plan. I cannot conceive of such a thing. I can't conceive of why they didn't. Even if you're not planning on using it, you have no leverage unless you have one. And, you know, if I had been there, clearly I would have been voting for an exit plan. What's interesting is the IMF is not supposed to make loans unless they are sustainable. And so it's interesting, they were very criticized for going along with the last Greek deal. So now they're not in the first round of the rejiggering with the Greeks. So they're not going to be in this first round. And they've come out with a report that says they don't think the deal is sustainable, but they've indicated they're planning on being in later rounds. It's going to be interesting to see how it works out. What that means is there's very powerful feedback now saying, you know, when you behave like this, when you do these kinds of predatory lending, you destroy the economy, which weakens the economy's ability to pay the debt back. If you want the debt paid back, or the optimal amount of debt that can be paid back, then you need to not destroy the economy. Duh. Interestingly enough, it's clearly the deal is perceived as good for Germany. It's back up. The DAX is now back up 20% for the year. Way ahead of the U.S. stock market at 3.86%, and obviously way ahead of China, which has now gone trounced. All these issues are going to come up in Puerto Rico. We're seeing Schumer now asking the Republicans to support him in supporting feasibility for Puerto Rico to declare bankruptcy for some of the agencies that have issued a lot of the debt. Yellen said this week in testimony, hands off the central bank on the Puerto Rican situation. So these conversations are coming, and they're going to be happening all over the world. And what's interesting is so much of what's gone on has been the equivalent of disaster capitalism or very predatory practices, and the feedback now is very strong. And, of course, seeing what's happening to Greece, this is a very destructive process. And when you look at both the Greek side and the European side, it's hard to imagine why you have to do this in a way that is so destructive. You'd have to be inside the deal to really understand it. I think the one group in Greece that's going to come out well on this is the Greek mafia, just like the Russian mafia came out very well on the U.S. Sort of destruction of the Soviet economy. And so you wonder what the real deal here is. Money and markets. What we saw last week was the establishment went to war, and the establishment won that one. Not only did the Greek people get rolled big time, but China's investors are out a great deal of money. One of the big questions on last week, how we see the deal with Iran. Clearly, it has to go through congressional approval, and it's being taken to the UN Security Council. But essentially, the deal's been made, and we see three pots of money that has everybody happy now and is, you know, the establishment is part of why they're licking their chops. First of all, you have the unfreezing of the Iran assets. different estimates of 100 billion to 150 billion frozen assets. And one of the questions I have is, in the G7, what companies are getting what deals related to what frozen assets? The second thing is we see trading with Iran now lifted. And what's interesting is if you look at all the countries that were party to the deal, three primary parties to the deal, U.S., U.K., and the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union and the Brits being the ones who invaded Iran in World War II. So there's a lot of history here to the group that's going in. The Brits very pleased announcing that they're prepared to open their embassy quickly. Apparently Cameron wants to move in quickly. We also see the sanctions lifting, and that means lots of trading for the companies that traditionally traded with Iran and know Iran well, Brits and Russians and Americans being three of them. And finally, of course, lower oil prices, which are going to help to sort of give a lot of easing to the sort of slowdown globally, and some here too, where consumers are really hurting. Again, I think all of the, whether it's trading with Iran or unfreezing the assets, it's going to be good for corporate earnings. And sure enough, you just see sort of lots of signs of it's morning in America. The U.S. dollar now up to 97.6, so really a very strong rise over the last 5 days. If you look at J.P. Morgan's stock, it's back up to 69. Lockheed Martin is now over 200. And again, real signs that it's morning of America. Big compliments from Obama for Putin, and you kind of wonder what the backdoor was on what Putin got out of the deal, and was there any connection to the Greek deal? Did cashing Putin in on the Iran deal cause him to pull the plug on Greece, and was that part of the switch after the vote? Some very murky politics going on here, and you see Obama publicly complimenting and thanking Putin. That's a very interesting turn of affairs. As I said, the administration is moving for the UN resolution and still has to get congressional approval, but I think given how many people are lining up to cash in on the deal, they're pretty confident of getting the congressional approval. As I said, every sign indicates that Iran and Greece are feeding the tapeworm, and the tapeworm is fat and happy. The VIX, which is an indication of volatility and fear in the market, collapsed, causing zero hedge to say there was the greatest meltdown in the fear index so far this year. Whatever the backdoor deals, and however much it's going to help the G7 corporate earnings, it's a lot of money because it was big enough to tell Israel to go take a hike, and that's been a long time coming. Clearly, though, the oil patch is hurting. This is going to be tough on the independent oil companies that depended on a high price for their fracking operations. We see the Saudis issue $4 billion bonds, which is very unusual given the, that really says the cash flows are hurting. And, of course, lower oil price is going to cut into Russia, so more hard times for Russia on the commodity side. Yellen testifying this week in Congress, she continues to threaten rising interest rates, and yet it's very hard, given what's happening economically globally, to imagine that the Fed's going to do it. We see none other than Bond King Jeff Gunlodge come out and say the Fed will not raise interest rates. They have to keep saying they're going to. But if you look at what's going on in the markets, they can't. I'm of the opinion that Yellen will raise rates before the end of the year, but it's going to be minor. It's going to be 25, maybe even 50 basis points. And I can certainly see why Gunlodge would think she wasn't, but I really think the Fed's got to do something before the end of the year. No matter what's going on in the economy, a lower gas price from Iran oil is going to help. The Chinese stock market, you really wonder, the U.S. is, and U.S. media has just been attacking that market for weeks and weeks and weeks before it dropped, and it really went running down last week. The question is, how much of this was to try and make sure that the IMF didn't approve China for the SDR system, saying their financial reforms weren't ready yet? But I also think part of what you're seeing is what I call a channel war, which is the Anglo-American Alliance saying we want you to go through the channel. So Alibaba comes public through the U.S. markets, whereas the Chinese market was booming and starting to do IPOs. And I think the feeling was that China's stock market and the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, between the two, China was sucking too much of the money through their channels too fast. And now with the U.S. market coming back and China getting pummeled, you know, sort of the U.S. channel is ascendant for now. So let's just take a look at the roundup of the markets. S&P now up 3.18% for the year. The DAX up 20%. Chinese large caps up 2.21% for the year. That's down from, they were up through 25%. The developed countries outside of North America up 7.5%, and I think some of that is obviously Europe and Germany. Emerging markets still down 1.22%, which oddly enough is exactly what the bond aggregate is down so far this year, down 1.22%. If you look at the bonds sort of off 1%, and the S&P now up 3%, it's, you know, it's a tough year for U.S. investors who stayed domestic to get any kind of yield. Long Treasury down 6.2%, that's TLT, the 20-year plus ETF. Gold now down 3.36%, silver down 4.71%. Of course, oil got hammered. It's down 19.38%, and the commodities index down 6.26%. So again, lots of signs flashing deflation. The Volcker rule goes into effect next week. That's July 21st. I think the banks are positioned to handle it. Certainly the Fed has taken an enormous amount of paper out of the banks and onto its balance sheet, so it really... I can't imagine that there's going to be a problem next week. The real problem comes in the long run, which is with so much money leaving the bond market and so much capacity leaving the bond market, if the Fed raises interest rates, how's the liquidity supposed to work? Will the electronic boards really handle the flow? And, you know, I think it depends on how fast money tries to move out, but certainly... if you're the Jeff Gunlatches of the world, I can understand why you'd be hoping the Fed wouldn't raise interest rates. One warning I'm seeing from subscribers all over North America and all over the world, but particularly North America, just tremendous pressure on people's time. And this is what happens when you go through a period of accelerating change. It creates what one author called shadow work. That's work that gets created for you. You know, you download a new piece of software and suddenly you've got to relearn how all the software works. Surprise, it's another 5 hours. Or this has happened to us several times this year. You have a credit card fraud, you have to cancel the card, you have to get a new card. Suddenly you've got, you know, you've got 2 hours of work. Property taxes are headed up, enforcement actions, enforcement fees, healthcare problems and family, friends are your own. And it's the kind of healthcare problems that come from increased stress. And all these things just create unbelievable amounts of more work. So I really want to caution people between now and the end of the year, budget time for shadow work. Just create a reserve. If you look at your allocation of time during the week, you just need to not schedule things. You need to leave more free time because this kind of shadow work is happening all over, and we need to be prepared to handle it. Our hero this week is Tama-chan, who was the station master cat. I kid you not, a railway line lost so much business that they ended up having to fire their station master. And a local cat who lived at the station became so endearing to the passengers that the cat, Tama-chan, was named station master of the Kishi station and ultimately vice president of the electric railway company. And the cat died on June 22nd at the age of 16 and inspired a full-page obituary in The Economist. Believe it or not, the president of the railway at the funeral ceremony estimated that the cat had brought in over $1 billion in local revenues and attracted so much tourist interest. So I have to tell you, I think that is one phenomenally good neighbor cat. Ask Catherine a couple of very good questions. Dear Catherine, first, may our Lord bless and keep you. Thanks for all you do and all the knowledge you share. I am a new member and honored to be one. Yes, we can say I'm Puerto Rican, my mom and pa are. So what that makes me, and let me add, I'm proud but concerned and disappointed American. Yes, American. Quickly, as you know, Puerto Rico is in turbulent waters now and is just about to clear bankruptcy. The island has been living high on the hog since at least the 60s and on max credit since the mid-80s. Now the party is over. For now, they say they would like to restructure the debt of almost $100 billion. I think they are in worse shape than Greece. My guess is that's right. And DC may have said that PR will not be bailed out. It's like being kept on hold, but yes, they have quietly collapsed. What do you think of this, and how do you think it will turn out? Will they harvest PR, and how? I will be looking on your fine website for your opinions and comments, although I understand you're a super busy lady and things are happening faster and faster. Truly, I cannot keep up with all. I don't know how you do it, but you do. Thank you. Love you and take lots of care. We need you now more than ever. The truth is a stubborn thing. God bless us all. Well, thank you so much for your kind words. I have it on my list to take a serious look at what is going on in Puerto Rico. And one of the reasons, I'll tell you why. I think the key to understanding what happens in Puerto Rico is that you are watching a fundamental reengineering of the Caribbean that's going on. First, the Dominican Republic has always had, I believe, very important New World Order installations and breakaway installations. It's a very important location. And I think it was one of the reasons that there was a real effort to kind of take over Haiti. If you haven't read my newest commentary, Clinton Cash, there's a few references in there. And so I think Haiti was really an effort to make sure that that whole island of the Dominican Republic and Haiti was under very tight control and in a position to be taken advantage of. Then if you look at Turks and Caicos, which is very small, but I think had a very instrumental role in sort of in the offshore havens and what's going on in the Caribbean, the movie of the week during the infrastructure wrap-up was the Worker Trilogy. The second movie of that three-movie series is Turks and Caicos, and you should read what I wrote about it in my review of the Worker Trilogy, as well as what I wrote about it in the wrap-up and what it says. It suggests, and I strongly recommend you watch the Worker Trilogy, because it will give you a sense of Turks and Caicos and some of the things I talk about in my various references to it. But I think that's a piece of the puzzle, and it's another piece of the puzzle is the deal with Cuba. And now we have the Clinton Foundation Energy Initiative for the Caribbean. Who's the players there? The key players are the U.S. and the Crown. The Crown has a lot of different interests, the British Virgin Islands, Turks and Caicos, obviously. And so I think you want to have a vision of what is happening in terms of reorganizing the Caribbean and what that's going to look like and what it means to the offshore havens, particularly the Crown havens, and how Puerto Rico fits into that. Franklin Templeton is one of the major players, and so one of the major players is going to be the big bondholders. Franklin Templeton, I think, being one of the most important. Franklin Templeton is also a major player in the Ukraine. So it's going to be interesting to see how they and some of the big banks approach it. So I have it on my list to look at the fundamental reengineering of where the Caribbean is going, and then from that, see where Puerto Rico fits in. But clearly there's going to be a pretty major reengineering, and so I appreciate your question, and we will do our best to try and figure it out. Dear Catherine, after hearing you mention the movies Eyes Wide Shut several times in recent years, I finally watched the movie. I was stunned at seeing the 15 to 20 minute scene following the showing the wild ritualistic sex orgy costume party, with the movie openly disclosing that the most powerful, wealthy, and elite people are attending these secret parties. With this in mind, do you think foul play might have been involved with when writer-director Stanley Kubrick died just 4 days after previewing the movie to his cast and his studio executives? Yes, I do think that foul play could have been involved. I think Kubrick really went to extraordinary lengths to explain sort of how the world operated. I think his name is Jay Widener, has a DVD on Kubrick and why he was so knowledgeable about how the world worked and was able to publish and produce so many quite extraordinary revealing movies. And I think if you want to sort of explore some of these theories, that's very much worth getting. Stanley Kubrick, in my opinion, was one of the great, great artists and movie makers of our time. Dear Catherine, I'm a new subscriber. If the answers already exist on your site, then please send me the link. Are we in a deflationary or inflationary scenario? How long do you see it lasting? Inflating monetary... Well, here's the thing. Inflation, strictly defined, inflation is growth in the money supply. Now, many people think of inflation as rise in prices. That's price inflation. But inflation, strictly speaking, is increase in the monetary supply. Depending on the statistics, what you're watching is the central banks increase the monetary supply, but then the economy is slowing and the trust slowing, and so the money supply, the multiplier, isn't multiplying what the central banks are creating as much. And so the central banks are trying to get monetary inflation, but there's a pushback from the sort of breakdown in trust, if you will, and the breakdown in fundamentals. And so the monetary inflation is not anywhere near as great as the outrageous money expansion by the central banks and the treasuries and the debt by the treasuries might indicate. What you do see is whatever the monetary inflation is, you see tremendous deflation occurring in the economy, particularly globalization deflates labor, new technology deflates labor and a lot of products and services. So we have some very powerful deflating forces. And then, of course, if we're going to, this was what I talked about in the wrap-up, are we going to collaborate or are we going to compete? If the reality is that you have to go through my channel and if you don't, I'm going to whack your stock market, then, you know, that all that kind of economic warfare and warfare is unbelievably deflating. And of course, we've seen a lot of the capital channeled into financial speculation and kept out of the real economy, piling up in the bond market. So for example, the feds have done tremendous amounts to keep banks from making loans into the small business and sort of general economy and keep the money pumping through the investment portfolio into treasuries and back into Washington. So centralization can be unbelievably deflationary. So I would say that we are in generally a deflationary environment. Now, because of the debasements of the currency, what you are seeing, and of course more people, less natural resources, peak everything concept, what we're seeing is inflation in expenses. So most people are experiencing a slow burn, which is incomes falling, expenses rising, you're getting squeezed. Then you ask, please explain your argument against a U.S. dollar collapse. The U.S. has lent dollars all around the world. That means you have tremendous fundamental demand for U.S. dollar. That demand can keep the U.S. dollar from collapsing for quite some period. But it all comes down, as I've discussed many times before, on invisible weaponry. In other words, what is the U.S.'s military advantage and how effective will that be? If we're depending entirely on force, I think that's not enough to keep it going forever. But I do believe, particularly if we convert to digital, that in theory the U.S. dollar could go for quite some time. Now, ultimately, we're clearly moving towards a global currency. Is that in 20 years, 50 years, 5 years? I don't know. I think it's dependent on many things that even the people leading this effort can't see. But to me, the U.S. dollar is, you know, the fastest I see a major drop in the dollar coming, assuming the invisible weaponry continues to have the advantage. I just think we're many years. And so give it for 2 to 5 years, we're definitely in a slow burn unless we go into war or unless the invisible weaponry politics change dramatically. And so a lot of this depends on the things we can't see that we can only engage in conjecture about. Does gold ever break free of its U.S. dollar relationship? I'm not sure what you mean by that, but gold's not going to break free of its relationship with the reserve currency, whatever that is, unless technology advances and we get to the point where you can literally turn tin into gold. I don't think we're there yet, but that's what's going to make a big difference. Another thing we have to contemplate is the trade in gold, a one planet phenomena, or is it multi-planet? And that has a very big impact on what you think could happen to gold. I think I do want to stress the one thing to think about in terms of the U.S. dollar is what the leadership wants is a digital currency, and they want a highly centralized system. And so they don't really care whether you call it dollars or wampum beads. But I think you want to look through the dollar and see where they want to go. What will be interesting this fall is when the SDR reconfigures. That'll be something to watch, and that may give us clues. Okay. Catherine, thank you so much for your work. You and your team are producing fantastic work, and I'm absolutely proud to be a member of the Solaria Report. Oh, well, thank you. A few months back, you wrote about the Ebola scare in the media and how they linked it with heavily racist overtones to the degree that you felt like you're living in Nazi Germany. I'm beginning to feel the same way. They're ratcheting up the xenophobic rhetoric with the Donald Trump narrative, and they've officially taken to the next level of the prison escape of El Chapo from prison. As a proud man of color, I cannot simply slough these media themes as nothing less than the next generation of Third Reich-style propaganda technologies. Am I off? Please advise. Thank you. The current propaganda is much more sophisticated than the Third Reich. The Third Reich was trying to target select groups. This effort is targeting everybody. And the key to targeting everybody is to play divide and conquer. And so it's in that sense, it's quite different than the Third Reich. And, of course, they have many more sort of entrainment mind control tools to work with. It's quite sophisticated. It might not always appear that way, and that's why it's very important not, whatever the attack is today, not to fall into the trap of thinking it's just you or it's your group, because this is designed to target everybody. What overseas vaulting service would you recommend, and how much of my precious metals portfolio should I have? How much of my portfolio should be in precious metals? In terms of recommending overseas vaulting services, I'm not in a position to do that. Let me tell you what I can do. I had done significant due diligence on gold money, and so I felt fairly comfortable. I felt pretty comfortable recommending them when I did. As for those of you who haven't heard, I have withdrawn my recommendation on them given the changes that are happening in the market and the changes that are happening at gold money. I still think it's a great management, a great group of people. So if you want to leave your money there, given the changes and making sure you understand what the changes are, certainly that's your call. The best offshore vaulting I know of is the Swiss banks, particularly the Canton banks. Given what's happened between the United States and Switzerland, it's now very difficult to establish a relationship there. And you really need quite a bit of assets, and you may even need a foreign corporation, depending on the situation. One of the questions is, should I keep them out of Canada? I really feel, and again, it depends on how much you have in assets and what your goals are. It really makes sense to have a core position in precious metals, and you want to have some easily accessible to you wherever you are, and you want to have some in another jurisdiction. So I'm a great believer, if you can, to have core near you and core outside. One place to check, if you don't know of a vaulting solution and you certainly don't have access to Swiss banks, is take a look at DasSafe in Vienna. They've been highly recommended. There are many others. I just haven't done the due diligence to tell you with the same confidence that once upon a time I had gold money. What you should do in terms of what percentage of your assets you should hold in precious metals, I strongly recommend you look at my blog post. It's called "What Percentage of My Assets Should I Hold in Precious Metals?" Essentially, what I say is right now you should have a core position, an investment position. If you don't have your core, you absolutely need to get it, because there is no doubt, despite the prices falling, that there is a tremendous squeeze in the physical market. So you really want to have your core. On the investment position, I'm not very excited. I think the charts on precious metals look weak. Our interview this week is with Jordan Malizio, terrific executive from ABC Bullion in Australia. Take a listen to that interview. Does a great argument of laying out the case for precious metals. He's a little bit more bullish than I. He thinks that the market may be, the prices in gold and silver may be bottoming. I'm a skeptic. I believe that there's a very good chance that the primary trend will reassert, but before it does, I think you could get a reasonably good chance of prices dropping as low as 1,100 to 700 on gold, and sort of an equivalent with a high silver ratio, gold-silver ratio on silver. I think there's a 20% chance that the primary trend won't reassert. We could see the basically the central banks run the wholesale price differently than the retail price, and a lot of ETFs and paper sort of step in to take up the demand if prices stay low. You know, the argument for ultimately the primary trend reasserting is you have such strength in the physical demand coming from Asia. So part of this depends on how the global economy isn't doing in Asia. But if we get a very strong dollar scenario, if the dollar heads through 100 again, I think we could see lower precious metals prices. So with that in mind, I'm not eager to take investment positions in precious metals. But again, you should have your core. And I would encourage you to go read that blog post, "What Percentage of My Assets Should I Hold in Precious Metals?" As I said, our interview this week was with Jordan Alicio from ABC Bullion. I asked him, in addition to bringing us up to date on the precious metals market, I asked him to review what's happening in the Australian economy, and he did a very good job of talking about how the global slowdown, particularly the slowdown in commodities, is affecting Australia. And part of what you're seeing in Australia very much reflects what you're seeing here in America. And a lot of it, both the deflation coming from globalization and from technology, new automation is hitting both the U.S. economy and Australia hard. And I would strongly recommend that, because it's a comment on sort of what we're seeing in Greece, which is we need to get back to building economies where we're trying to help each other succeed. We've about run the sort of central banking warfare string, I think, as far as it's going to go. I'm Cynthia McKinney, and we're going to be talking about what the real issue should be if we had a real election for 2016. So what are the big issues coming up from someone who played a very important role in Congress for many years and astonishingly bright and honest and fearless political leader. Then July 30th, the Salieri Report with John Rappaport. And Franklin's going to come on August 13th for A Free and Inspired Life. And I'm going to move in a great conversation I just had with Joseph Farrell in person and live that we had discussing infrastructure and the second quarter wrap-up. Very exciting conversation with Joseph. He has a new book out, and I think you're going to be really enjoy listening to that one. So, ladies and gentlemen, until July 23rd, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Good night, and good luck.